This is the Communication Research Podcast, a production of the Communication Research Center at Boston University. In this podcast, we have an interview with Mary Beth Oliver, Distinguished Professor in the College of Communication at Penn State University. The topic, Media Appreciation as a Response to Moral Beauty. Hello and welcome to another edition of the Communication Research Podcast, a production of the Communication Research Center here at Boston University. My name is James Shanahan, a professor in the College of Communication, and it is our pleasure to have as our guest today Mary Beth Oliver, who is a distinguished professor in the College of Communication at Penn State and also co-director of the Media Effects Research Laboratory there. Mary Beth, thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
And also with us to help with the interviewing duties is Mina Tsai. She's a visiting assistant professor here in the College of Communication and also was the doctoral student of Mary Beth at Penn State. Thanks for coming, Mina.
Thank you.
And we're happy to have Mary Beth here to present a colloquium later today to our students and faculty, the title of which I'm now completely blanking on. It is Media Appreciation as a Response to Moral Beauty, correct?
That's right.
Excellent. And so we'll talk some about that, and we'll also talk a bit about your article, a recent article in Human Communication Research entitled Appreciation as an Audience Response, Exploring Entertainment Gratifications Beyond Hedonism. So the basic theme of our talk today will deal with media appreciation and enjoyment, how they're similar, how they're different. Let's get started. What can you tell us, Mary Beth, essentially about the motivation to write this particular article, which, by the way, appears in Human Communication Research? How'd you get started on this line of investigation?
Well, in media psychology, which is this area that I work in, and it's mainly social scientific studies, the theories that people have used throughout the year, very influential theories, have largely been preoccupied, I would say, with the idea that enjoyment is the ultimate sort of goal that we have when we watch entertainment. And that's also the desired outcome. So when we choose to watch something, we want to be entertained, we want to experience enjoyment. And that makes sense, largely. I think it probably accounts for the largest share of entertainment use. But there are notable exceptions to that. And the theorizing kind of scratches its head at why somebody would ever choose to view something that presumably wouldn't characterize it as enjoyable. Hotel Rwanda, you know. Why is that? In fact, a lot of notable films, very, very, very notable, important films. People wouldn't really say that they enjoy them. And so the theorizing kind of was throwing its hands in the air and saying, I don't know what's going on. And so that's really what motivated it.
Now, and that's very interesting. When I think about, and I don't know quite as much about the later research on enjoyment, but when I think about the early theorizing on why people would pay attention at all to media, one thinks immediately of uses and gratifications. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like that body of research, as large as it is, never has really come up with a consistent concept, a gratification, if you will, that relates to what you're calling appreciation, right? I mean, if they've got entertainment, in socialization, surveillance, you know, these types of functions, you know, would that be too broad of a statement, or?
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think there, I can think of one, maybe two studies that made passing reference to something that I think is getting a little closer to the notion of appreciation. But that certainly wasn't the focus, it wasn't something that was investigated further.
Right.
So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It just hasn't received a whole lot of attention.
Right. And then this is just a question in the later work on media enjoyment, to use that term, and I know Mina's done work in this area as well. Has it come up much at all as well, or have these folks also tended to sort of buy into the you use the word hedonism, in other words, pleasurable here. So is this dominating even the recent research? What would you say, Mina?
Right. I actually think it's fascinating because, right, a lot of the ways in which people have looked at enjoyment has been very unidimensional. And the way in which Mary Beth has addressed it in this article clearly says that pleasure is one form of gratification, but this other line of research that may address why it is that people seek meaning sometimes out of films or find in a way the idea of contemplating human life and really getting into states where they're reflecting on what they have or reflecting on depictions of what other people have in media, and why certain films like sad tragedies can also be deemed enjoyable is fascinating, because some programs that are films, right, you can say you might appreciate, but not really elicit this pleasurable sense of, that this is fun or thrilling. And then there are films in which I can think of from my own personal life that I find both enjoyable and that I appreciate. So are there different genres that tend to provoke certain levels of higher appreciation or higher enjoyment, or even the combination, I think is fascinating. And so one thing that I wanted to kind of put out there and as a question to Mary Beth is, in some cases, with different genres and with the focus for those who haven't read your work, what genres do you think in some ways elicit greater appreciation responses, or at least you can make the argument that people would actually say they're more likely to show appreciation versus enjoyment.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I do think that there are certain genres that elicit that response more readily, but I think you're absolutely right too, that you can do both. I mean, I don't want to suggest that appreciation, if you appreciate something, you don't enjoy it, or vice versa. But it's just it's another dimension that I just want to. I think it's useful. So, in terms of genres that I would say people really appreciate more than enjoy, I mean, certainly dramas, are one of them, or sad films. And it's not. And here's the thing, it's not that I think that when people say they appreciate something or they want to view something that will lead to that appreciation, that they're necessarily seeking something that's sad. But I think that what they're seeking is something that has important lessons about life to convey. And, life is joyful and life is beautiful, but it also has its tragic elements to it too. And so when you start thinking about, films that contemplate the meaning of life, or films that really kind of make you grapple with human poignancies, there's a, it's both, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah, on. And I agree with what you're saying. The fascinating thing to me, though, is that as a discipline, we could have been engaged in empirical research on this topic for lo these many years, since the 60s at least, right, with social scientific studies, if not earlier, and have focused almost entirely on the sort of the pleasurable, the enjoyable, the fun, the informative, things that serve us. If we looked at sort of the traditional four functions of the mass media, they're all things that we need to either feel good or to get resources, that kind of thing. And the idea that a whole, what might be an entire separate hemisphere of human experience is sort of left aside by our discipline, not on purpose, obviously, is interesting. And as we'll get into in discussion of your paper here, you go back to observations from the Greeks, who of course were very interested in tragedy and its roles and functions and so forth, and this and that's worth discussing as well. So, tell me about essentially this paper is three studies looking at this dimension of appreciation, not as entirely separate from enjoyment, but as definitely having a different kind of meaning and connotation. So tell me and tell our listeners a bit about how these three studies are structured and sort of the flow of your thinking and leading towards your final conclusion about how we should conceptualize what is enjoyment as compared to appreciation and some of the other gratifications that we might get from media use as well.
Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, a goal was, a real prominent goal that we had was to come, is to see if we are making a viable argument. And,
right.
And part of that is to establish whether or not we could actually assess it or measure it in a way that would differentiate appreciation from enjoyment. And it's funny because I don't think that just the average person, if you asked them, did you enjoy that? Did you appreciate this? I think we tend to use those words interchangeably
right.
a lot. And so when we first started doing the research, we had to be very open-ended and just let people tell us
mm-hmm.
and let us have the ability to listen to mm-hmm. what people were telling us for what made for enjoyment and
right.
what didn't. And so from there, then you go and you start to see themes and you start to narrow and focus. And so we were trying to establish what sorts of genres, like Mina was asking, would be more closely aligned with one or the other. We wanted to see... Could we predict it by giving people films and that we knew elicited different kinds of emotional responses and see if our measures held up? And then we wanted to see if our measures would actually work in a more realistic setting, because, you know, like many social scientists, we were kind of doing these with undergrad audiences, and we were doing these in online questionnaires. So we wanted to see mm-hmm. if it would work after people watched an actual series of films.
Right.
So, you know, that's generally what we were up to there. This is one part of a series of studies that we're doing. But the goal here was to see, can we assess it?
Okay, so let me just give some details on the study for listeners who are interested. This is by Mary Beth and your co-author, Ann Barge, who is from the Department of Media and Communication Studies at the Martin Luther University in Halle,
mm-hmm.
Germany. So this is in volume 36. And so it's really three studies. The first, exploratory, identifying the possibilities of what this sort of, I don't want to call it a missing dimension or a missing link, but it's mm-hmm. it's got that flavor to it. In the second study reported in this paper, you're trying to confirm, does that exist? And then the third study, you're showing real films to people and seeing how well these categorizations work. One thing popped into my mind. A lot of times when films are advertised, and I think we were talking earlier about an example that you might have had would be Hotel Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
They're certainly not going to say, you'll find this one of the most enjoyable experiences. But they will say compelling mm-hmm. drama, something like that. And compelling is often an adjective that I encounter, you know, for films like this. Mm-hmm. And then there's the question is, compelled to what, right? Is it, and I'm sort of throwing this out, compelled to reflect, compelled to think, compelled to compare my situation to their situation. In other words, why is it that I would pay $10 to see Hotel Rwanda? Obviously, I'm opting in, right? Not necessarily to enjoy, you know, an entertainment, but because there is some compulsion there. Is that a reasonable metaphor in your view?
Yeah, I think it's. I think you're right on target there. And here's why I say that. In kind of companion work to this, we were looking at different motivations that people had for viewing for viewing entertainment. Even the word entertainment is loaded, but for viewing mm-hmm. media. And we were trying to contrast hedonic motivations mm-hmm. or seeking pleasure with, and again, we're, you know, borrowing from Greek literature,
yep.
With eudaimonic, we call it eudaimonic motivations, which is basically seeking meaning.
Right.
And so in doing that, we were also developing measures of those motivations. And one way to assess the validity is to look to see what kind of personality characteristics are associated with these different inclinations, these
yep.
different preferences. Well, for eudaimonic motivations, which is most akin to appreciation,
right.
need for cognition
yep.
is a biggie. So people who enjoy thinking hard about things, people who like contemplating puzzles,
mm-hmm.
these people. Another one was people who scored high on a measure of what's called search for meaning in life. And so these were people who would agree with statements like, I'm always searching for what the purpose of life and stuff like this. Now, interestingly enough, having found meaning in life wasn't associated with it. So it's the search.
So there is a compulsion or a...
Yeah.
Yeah. And interesting, you mentioned eudaimonic. I read that in your article. You cited Aristotle, and I decided to look it up.
Ah.
Well, and it's and the way you're describing it is very similar to at least one of these definitions. This comes from Nicomachean Ethics, where he's saying he's talking about what does political science aim to do, and it just gives a very sort of clean definition of eudaimonic, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas many people would say happiness is, well, I have, you know, the nicest house or the, you know, the nicest toys or whatever. He's saying, and here I'm just quoting, "Let us resume our inquiry and state, in view of the fact that all knowledge and choice aims at some good, what it is that we say political science aims at, and what is the highest of all goods achievable by action. Verbally, there is very general agreement, for both the general run of men and people of superior refinement say that it is happiness, and living well and faring well with being happy." And I think it's that this living well and faring well are sometimes translated as doing well, so living and doing well. And this is in Plato, too, as I recall, doesn't always line up with having, you know, the best, tastiest food or the nicest house. So there's, you know, of course, much of television is, or any media is aimed precisely at the opposite of what you're talking about, which is a need for anti-cognition in some, you know,
yeah.
I don't know if we have a scale for that, right? And, you know, I'm not going to watch my favorite baseball team in a search for meaning, that kind of thing. So is that sort of original take on eudaimonic happiness kind of in line with what you're seeing in personality type, that living well and doing well?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, when one looks at additional writings, you know, that Aristotle talks about, and he elaborates on eudaimonic life, or eudaimonia.
Mm-hmm.
It's flourishing, living a life that's flourishing. By that, what is meant is that it is leading a life that embodies moral virtue. And hence, that's why I'm talking today about media, entertainment, and moral beauty. Because, so what do you mean by moral virtue? It's not goody-two-shoes. It's like the importance of things, virtues like trust or courage or love.
Right.
And, you know, I think that a lot of times we're so ready to think of media entertainment as in terms of sheer pleasure, just sheer, you know, junk food, that we can't even conceive, or it's hard for us to even talk about how it's also can serve this end of helping us to contemplate the good life.
Well, and a question I could pose this to both of you, because I'm sure you're both thinking about it, is it, if we think that there's a bias in the media effects research tradition to focus on problems and, you know, negative issues with media, whether it's sex, violence, these types of things, and then say, why do they exist? Well, it's because people are seeking pleasure through media, and they're not really paying attention to these sorts of ways of flourishing that you're talking about. Does this sort of altering of a mindset towards a different kind of media appreciation, what have you, does it open up more possibilities for looking at any sorts of media, be it television, film, in more positive ways than we've normally done? Would it tend to change our... and I'm stating that I think there's kind of a bias towards the negative. So what's you guys' position on that?
Actually, I did want to comment before when you said, you know, is there this need for absence of, you
absence
know,
cognition. Vegetation.
In some cases, you know, I think that need for escapism really, you know, it tests that in the sense that, you know, that people who don't want to think, right, they turn to television as more so for pastime, convenience, or habitual viewing. And so these are the people who wouldn't necessarily... might be less inclined to take on this mm-hmm. experiential process of appreciating mm-hmm. content, but more so attain what Mary Beth, you know, had mentioned was that you know, unidimensional kind of that seeking pleasure for the sake of enjoyment. Right. But one thing I think is interesting is that the way in which at least Mary Beth's first study had touched up on was that there are different forms of appreciation, that sometimes we appreciate things for artistic value, sometimes we appreciate things mm-hmm. for to attain profound meaning, and then there are other times in which it gives us lasting impressions. And I think mm-hmm. that's kind of interesting how those came up as different dimensions, and not just to think that it's only that, you know, this idea of meaning is unidimensional. Mm-hmm. But definitely I think with this area of appreciation that, you know, what Mary Beth had just alluded to with eudaimonia as producing in some cases different variations of states. And I'm actually, my question I had wanted to put out there is this idea of tenderness that came up in some of your previous work, Mary Beth, that was published, and I was kind of, you know, focusing on this one word, trying to get at what you meant by tenderness, or this idea, because it's kind of in some ways described as positive and negative mm-hmm. in terms of affective responses, mm-hmm. and so that was something that mm-hmm. really intrigued me that mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah, I'd be delighted to talk about that and hear your reactions, and I think it does lead into your mm-hmm. question too then mm-hmm. About how it might help us focus on the positive mm-hmm. too. So yeah, with tenderness, here's the thing that because of the research in media psychology and entertainment psychology, its focus on enjoyment, it tended to assume audience emotional responses that were on the positive valence, so happy, joyful, entertained, pleased, and these kind of things. Mm-hmm. And it not only did it focus on that, but it assumed that if you weren't positive, then you were negative. So if you were positive, you're in a negative mood. If you're not positive, you're in a negative mood, and vice versa. Okay. Well, what was happening is that I would measure people's responses to entertainment, and I would analyze their responses and see which kind of words hung together. And what I was finding is that there was a certain group of words that would hang together a lot when it came to looking at entertainment that they would say was appreciated. And those words were words like tender. I felt tender. I felt moved. I felt poignant. I felt contemplative. I felt sometimes sympathetic. Verklempt, although we didn't really use that word in our questionnaire, but you kind of get the idea. And so then our question was, well, is that positive or negative? And we kept trying to fit that into the way that it had been measured, and it wasn't fitting well. And when we started dissecting it a little bit more, what we were finding is that it truly is an example of what we believe to be a mixed affect. That it's a little bit of both, simultaneously.
Right. So it would be simplistic to assume that all affect is very unidimensional and that you're either happy or not happy. And I'm having a problem coming up with a term now, but the notion of something being bittersweet, for instance.
Exactly.
Right.
Maybe
exactly.
That would be an example.
Yeah.
Because when you said, when I read your paper and I was thinking about the title of your talk today, and the word appreciation made me think about, you know, courses. And I think you mentioned this, you know, film appreciation, music appreciation, as, you know, well, first of all, this is something we have to teach people. You know, in the case of music, let's say, you know, you're going to learn how to appreciate Beethoven. If, you know, if you heard it normally, you'd be, oh, that's just a bunch of, you know, but by the time you're done, you'll be crying at the end, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
But there's plenty of music, for instance, that I listen to that can make me feel sad or happy and sad at the same time, and a variety of mixed emotions. And it led me to question, and you alluded to this also, really the meaning of the word enjoyment. It can, you know, in most of the studies, it means I'm happy, I'm getting pleasure, this is, you know, I'm having a good time, I'm escaping, whatever. But if we were to describe a life to someone without the experience of sadness or without the experience of a variety of negative emotions, of course, most people don't want to have those. But if we lost those, I think almost everyone would agree we would lose meaning, right? So not to get overly philosophical, but the notion that positive emotions, hedonically pleasure, you know, hedonically positive pleasure, enjoyment, and so forth, gain meaning from other kinds of emotions, be they opposite or just different. It seems like this is something that's, and you tell me, is really just starting to be investigated empirically in our media effects literature. Would that be correct?
I would not only agree with that, but be investigated per se. I mean, it's a real debate, right? That
so in psychology too?
Yes.
Okay.
And
that amazes me.
Me too, because you know, at one point in struggling to try to identify this emotion that I was calling tenderness, because you know we all experience that, you know.
Yep.
And I thought, well, certainly. I mean, not only do we experience it, but it's like it's often a very profound thing when we experience it. And so I thought, surely, you know, there's got to be a vast literature, you know. And so a colleague of mine, who is in the psychology department, who is a member of a professional organization on emotion, said, I'll help you locate other emotion researchers, and I'll send your question out to the organization.
Sure.
Well, she did. And I was expecting to get all of these wonderful citations and help. And I didn't get any wonderful citations. I got loads of email from psychologists all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
Telling me about their most profound, tender, poignant moments in their lives.
But no,
it was very distressed. Right. Well,
I don't need that.
Yeah. But I am starting to see some people acknowledging it and pointing to it. And one person that comes to mind, and I think he's doing just some fantastic work, is a guy named Jonathan Haidt, who is at UVA. Characterize his work as situated in positive psychology.
Right.
And I think that's where a lot of the action is as far as this goes. And he talks about other praising emotions. And it might be something like having gratitude towards somebody, or it might be having admiration for somebody. But the one emotion that I think is closest to what I'm talking about is being elevated by somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, his working definition of elevation is the emotional response that we feel to witnessing moral beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that's cool, and so this kind of lets me segue to your question about the positive effects.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that's really fantastic and hopeful about that research is that when we experience elevation, and it's very transcendent, it's not about my pleasure, you know, it's about something bigger than me.
Mm-hmm.
And when we feel that, there's a motivational outcome
mm-hmm.
of it, and that motivational outcome is essentially to be a better person.
Right.
And that, I think, holds a great deal of power, and I can't wait to study how to harness that.
I agree, and I did want to go back to Jim's question about these pro-social effects. What can be beneficial from this line of research and really looking at appreciation on a deeper level, and even looking at in the area of behavior and seeing how, and I'll bring up an example from Mary Beth's a presentation that she had had done in this conference called Entertainment Equals Emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a fascinating discussion that we had about just talking about the ways in which when you do reach this level of enlightenment or elevation, is what you're referring to, Mary Beth, that you not only feel like a better person, but you want to go beyond and actually exhibit that through behavior. You know, Mary Beth showed this clip of people donating their clothes to a charity, and this jacket was actually one of these. It was, you know, the object, and you know, you felt while you were watching this clip of this one jacket being gifts, you know, given from one person to another, passing on, you know. And at the very end, actually, it was one of those situations in which you can put a name in, you know, a commercial or this internet, you know.
Customized
type of, I guess, commercial, right, where you can brand it. And so it was really interesting because Mary Beth put my name, and then at the very end you saw my name on this, you know, jacket. And then when I came back, I felt so inspired when I saw this commercial and learning mm-hmm. about, you know, this idea of donating to people who are in need. And then I came back, actually I took my jacket that I traveled to at this conference and actually donated it to a charity event. And it's one of those things where, like Mary Beth mentioned earlier, is when you go through a process in which, you know, she often refers to the article, these serious pensive states, and you're reflecting on your life, or you might come up with these revelations about what, you know, the world is like that you might not have thought about, you know, mm-hmm. that does it influence positive behaviors down the road? And mm-hmm. I think you can only reach that level if you go through this process of appreciation or this kind of very deep cognitive
Let me just ask a question here then too. And because, you know, we're talking about being fulfilled, enlightened, or elevated, to use your term, Mary Beth. And I think that's an experience that everyone has had at some point through some confluence of events, whether it be personal or something you see vicariously through the media. We've been elevated to the point where, yes, indeed, we might be motivated to take action, whether it's to donate to a charity or just to help somebody in your family or a friend or what have you. Now, not to puncture the balloon too much, how wonderful that is. And the way you talk about it, Mina, especially suggests, you know, there's a process of going through that to get there. In terms of a state that we can be in for extended periods of time, I would imagine, I'm not sure what the psychology would say on this, that it's difficult to remain elevated.
Sure.
And that perhaps one of the reasons why so much of the media psychology and other media effects research has focused on the entertainment and the hedonic aspect is that this might be the sort of default condition to which we return when we're not investing the energy, so to speak, the spiritual, mental, and other kinds of energy that we need to be at that level. Do you think that, and so would this explain why, you know, the vast majority of studies are about, let's say, television's role as escapist, commercial, you know, garbage, really, and the negative effects of that, because that's where most of us go when we're not, you know, in other words, is it a special condition to which one must aspire greatly and make special effort to reach, to be dealing with what, whether we call it appreciation, elevation, what have you? What do you think about that kind of observation?
Well, I think you're right that the vast majority of entertainment landscape is not this, you know, and because it is, it's draining
right.
to experience it. And I don't think we can sustain it, you
right.
know, and so, and that may very well explain why that's been the focus or the assumption of the research that's been
right.
going on. But to say that it's the majority or that appreciated entertainment is the minority, that's one thing. But to lose it altogether is another. And that has been a little bit of a concern that I've had with entertainment, changes in the entertainment landscape. And
mm-hmm.
so... Here is what people would say that they experience when they experience enjoyment with no appreciation.
Right.
They would call it a guilty pleasure.
Yeah. They watched American Idol or... Oh, wait, hey. Nina, you like that. Sorry. Let me edit that out. What's a guilty pleasure?
But I think it's so interesting. Right, that Mary Beth, you termed, like, guilty pleasure to say, you know, you can enjoy something even if you don't appreciate,
yeah.
you should somehow feel like it's socially undesirable, you know, and I think that's an interesting term.
Yeah, and one, I mean, it is an interesting term, but imagine that we felt nothing but guilt. Well, that we, in other words, that we had nothing that we appreciated. And that's when you, well, we think, oh, well, how could that happen? But look to what is the biggest, fastest growing type of media entertainment out there right now? And it's video games, naturally. Mm-hmm. And so one question that's been haunting gamers, and now it's haunting me, and the question that they ask is, can a video game make you cry?
Yeah.
And
I mean, some of our listeners, you know, will be old enough to remember, well, everybody's heard this phrase. My father used to refer to television as the boob tube, right? You know, and the metaphor is that it's sort of, while you're watching, it's sucking your brain cells out, right? And it's turning you into a couch potato. And looking at what I watched as a kid, I don't blame him at all. I don't think the Flintstones was really elevating me in the way to a eudaimonic state that you talked about. And now, you know, as a parent, I might find myself saying the same thing, you know, to younger members of my family. If it seems as if they're constantly glued to a Game Boy or to a console, and it's sort of a repetitive, you know, it's pleasurable in the sense I'm shooting the aliens or I'm getting to the next level, it is hard to see where the elevation is there. So that would lead me to the question, is it because video games aren't sufficiently narratively rich that they're able to do that yet? Would that be a...
I think that's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that question. One thing that I hope to talk about later today in the colloquium is this very issue. I mean, and I can think of a lot of reasons why they might not be there yet. Well, first of all, they're certainly not there yet.
Right.
And even among heavy gamers,
right.
There's not this level of self-reported feelings of enrichment from playing games as there is from, say, watching a film or even listening to music or reading a book. And okay, so why wouldn't that be? Well, maybe it's that there aren't many narrative games, although I think that's changing.
Right. I understand that narrativity is a big concern, and the technology is improving to allow for more of a, instead of just following, you know, a path, whether it be a first-person shooter, there are storylines in games.
Yeah.
The question more is, are they complex or rich enough to get us to this state that you're talking about? My suspicion is that they aren't quite there, although I'm not an expert on games by any means. So asking the same question as you, if a video game, you know, I think a video game can make you pump your fist, you know, oh, wow, I got to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen people get very excited and involved, or what we might call transported almost, right? These are all qualities that are probably preconditions to being, to feeling tenderness or to being moved to cry. But if they haven't reached that ultimate state, part of it I would think would be narrative richness or the complexity to do that, although not to deny that there couldn't be other factors.
Right. I actually think one element could be character identification,
uh-huh.
that you can still have a very simple narrative, but if you have one character in which you clearly can identify with, or a term in...
Mm-hmm.
In the media literature, this idea of a parasocial interaction that you can have, these intense psychological relationships we can develop with these characters where we're very attracted to them, and whatever happens to them, you know, if they fall or they experience agony, we cry with them, and if they experience glory and they succeed and move on to the next level, we get extremely excited. But that identification could, of course, be very short-lived. If you play a game and you move up in the rankings and you do well, then you can, that excitement could be pleasure, thrill, fun, whatever term you want to call that. But then I do think that appreciation could also fit well in that context, because it could be very meaningful meaningful to you who this character is. Like Nintendo Wii can be you as the character, right? The me who looks exactly like you, and the ways in which video games have actually afforded greater personalization options, mm-hmm. that so you actually feel that immersion more, that transportation more. So could it be that, right, if video games had much more complex narratives, you know, with the development of, you know, much more complicated types of games in which, you know, your character or you yourself is moving around in a console, you actually feel like you're not just an audience, but you are part of the game. Could, in some ways, appreciation could be greater or more enhanced, would be something I would be curious about. But also the idea of artistic value that I think your first study had found it was a dimension in of itself. I think some people really get captivated by the fact that technology has been able to afford a different type of experience for, you know, for users, especially video games, where things look more real. And you have, you know, the Xbox console that are coming out with things that if you move closer to it or you touch the screen, you know, they can sense and they can actually have a world that reacts to you. And so in some cases, I feel as if that immersion process might make it much more likely for people to engage in maybe this contemplative state of eudaimonia, or whether it be, you know, that it could still heighten enjoyment, but that these features maybe shouldn't be overlooked.
Well, it's and maybe narrative complexity is not the best, is not the word I meant, but something, you know, when I, and this is really, to frame it as a question, when I read a lot of the studies, not just necessarily yours, on be it media enjoyment, emotion, so forth, inevitably there's, especially if they're experimental studies, there's a need to break it down, with emotions, for instance, as variables. And my tendency is to go back and think about what would those emotions, let's say the ones you're talking about, mean in the context of some overarching structure, which I usually think would be a narrative, right? And I think one of the problems is it's harder to sort of measure a narrative. You know, how do we sort of measure that, right? I mean, we can expose people to different kinds of narratives, but it's harder to break that down in the way we can say, okay, we've got emotion terms that might stand for them and then factor analyze them and so forth. It raises a question. Sometimes I think, and I'm interested in your opinion, Mary Beth, is we will encounter these moments in the media when least expected, and even when we think we're having a guilty pleasure. I picked on American Idol earlier, but now I'm thinking of Susan Boyle, who everyone knows, right? And she came out and looked like, you know, this would be horrifying, you know, she can't sing. And then she sings a beautiful song, and you can see even the judges are holding back the tears, right? That's a storyline, but it takes about 30 seconds. It's not a complex story, I guess. Do you think this is an example of, is that enjoyment? Is that appreciation? Is this happiness for them? Is it happiness that we can be part of that? Is it just, we don't know what it is, we're mixed up, you know? Like, why did I get, sorry, you know, the other guy too, Paul Potts, remember him?
Laughing because both of those examples I'll point to today.
In your talk, I didn't know that. I want to tell the listeners I did not know that. So, geniuses think alike. Well, then explain that to me, because especially when I watched Paul Potts, I was like, oh my God, that guy's awesome. I love this. This is great. What's happening there? Besides getting verklempt, as you said.
Yeah, yeah. You were exemplifying verklemptness perfectly. Yeah. Actually, I love those examples, and part of the reason that I love those examples is that when you talk about appreciation, there's this danger that you sound like you're coming off talking about highbrow versus lowbrow culture,
right.
And I don't think that what we're talking about is just highbrow, because you see it in many forms of popular culture, just like,
right.
You know, like these, and so is the question, why did you feel that way? I think.
Should ask my therapist, probably.
Yeah,
right?
Maybe. Well, I mean, I do think that what these people were exemplifying here
was something bigger than just that moment. It's mm-hmm. something big. It's something that we see as valuable about the human spirit. That mm-hmm. is about. This is about moral beauty. It's about courage. It's about hopefulness. It's about overcoming the odds. You know, something. And it's bigger and it's transcendent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you didn't look at it. You didn't cry because. If you watch someone come out there,
I just want to say I'm not saying that I cry. That's just I'm going on the record. But you know, I moved.
I well, hope that I cried.
Maybe, maybe a, you know, a small
a tear. Yeah. One tear came down.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
But I would say that if a singer came out. And he or she sang a beautiful song, and that was it, and won mm-hmm. and won the votes in and of itself. That wouldn't move someone
right.
to the certain extent. So it's a bigger lesson that's being learned, and I think that's what moves us because then we reflect on like what is important about life, and it's not about winning.
Right.
It's about embodying
right.
these virtues.
But now that we're talking about this, I recall that Mina and I actually talked about this in our very first podcast where you were the guest. I'm pretty sure if we go back and roll the tape, we'll see that we discussed boil or pots. And I think part of it there, too, is the unexpected. The compellingness of it is if Mariah Carey comes out and sings a great song, it can move okay. you, but it lacks the, you know, the surprising and the tenderness aspect of it, which is the way, for instance, the Susan Boyle thing or even the Paul Potts thing was set up, I think it required the judge's skeptical and almost mean behavior, you know, right. like Simon Cowell being such a jerk, like
yeah.
sitting back like, all right, you know, go ahead. And then, oh, wow, it's great to see someone like Simon Cowell get shut down. And he has to admit it, right? And she is, and she's a beautiful person in some way is kind of the lesson of that.
Yeah.
Now, I think, you know, the world's great religions have spent thousands of years trying to teach us these things and I suppose how to attain these states. Media effects research moving in that direction is a pretty interesting development if we're coming at it from a social scientific and an empirical angle. And I wanted to ask you a question about the positive psychology movement that you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not very well read on this, but I've read some about it. I know you've said it's kind of a hot area, science of happiness and positive psychology, also attracted some criticism inevitably, I suppose. How's that affecting us in media effects research? Is this just grabbing a hold at all, or who's dealing with it that we know of besides people sitting in this room, excluding myself?
No, I think that Mina mentioned we went to, mm-hmm. we were at a conference
right.
in Spain in the fall on entertainment equals emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me that that was a very hot topic
mm-hmm.
there. And, you know, these were scholars who are looking at video, from video games to films to television, you know, and I think people are kind of blossoming out of the overwhelming assumption of hedonism that
mm-hmm.
we've been living under. And we've been, you know, doing all sorts of contortions to maintain the assumption that we're all just hedonists. And it's almost liberating to say,
yeah.
wait a minute, maybe we also seek truth, you know, in addition to pleasure. And so I think it's kind of it's becoming a very important area. I also think that there's a lot of growth going on in media effects, too, as a result of becoming inspired by and really joining forces with people in the humanities.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, all of a sudden, because, you know, film scholars
right.
have been talking about this for a long time,
right.
and you know, and we're acting like we're, you know, inventing the wheel. Of course,
right.
we're not. We're just doing it quantitatively, social scientifically now. So we have a lot to learn from them.
Well, one of the things I always know when I'm teaching basic comm theory is, you know, if we look at the various traditions of empirical research, you know, in the social scientific tradition. It does seem a lot of times that we're catching up with people like Aristotle or, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's like, and so, and clearly, you know, long traditions of thinking about questions of truth and beauty and good in the humanities as well may have evaded us to a certain extent. And I think it's going to be interesting to look at how and whether those can catch a toehold or a foothold in the kinds of analysis that we do. I think if they can, all to the better. Some final questions here before we wrap up. In the conclusion of your study, you sort of say, and I'm paraphrasing here, and correct me if my memory is failing me here, is that you think we sort of need a language that looks at kind of three dimensions, if you will, of why we would pay attention to media. One being enjoyment, right? Another being appreciation, in which we've talked a lot about. And then in sort of, I'm not sure if you conceive it as in the middle or apart or separate, is this question of when we watch media for reasons of being thrilled or experiencing suspense, it seemed to me that you were positing that as a different kind of experience, right? But didn't see sort of a natural language term for that. So could you expand a little bit on that third aspect of media use, for, you know, the thrill and suspense aspect? Is that enjoyment? Is it appreciation? Is it a third thing?
Yeah.
What do we do with that?
That's a great question. I mean, part of the reason why we're kind of puzzling about it is because we have to confront the reality of our data.
Right.
And the data, we're not placing kind of a thrill gratification in line with either enjoyment or
right.
or with appreciation. So, you know, so maybe there's a third dimension when we start getting, you know, three-dimensional,
right.
If you will. Because I can imagine a thrilling thing that's that we appreciate and so forth, and we
yep.
can look in these quadrants. But the way that we had operationalized enjoyment was really more on the sort of the fun side.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, if you take a movie or something like some a gruesome movie, something like Saw,
yeah,
or Hostel,
yep.
you know, I don't think people would say, boy, that was fun, nor would they say, you know, geez, I've really
I
found
really
deep meaning in that. And yet there's
but they do pay to see it.
They do pay to see it. So there's clearly some sort of gratification that's going on that we didn't feel comfortable characterizing as either one of these two dimensions. We didn't investigate it heavily. That wasn't really our goal. But I think it's there. We can't deny it. And we need to.
But you did point out, I mean, isn't it true that other studies have found that the experience of feeling suspense or being thrilled or what have you is a predictor of enjoyment as others have conceived it? That's a fairly, is that a fairly traditional, conventional finding?
Well, yeah. I mean, I do
think... Like being transported into a thrilling, suspenseful narrative is inherently, you know, it's scary while you're doing it, but it's almost like riding a roller coaster
mm-hmm.
kind of experience.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah. No, it does. It does. And it's just the way that it differs, I guess. I mean, it's similar at the sort of meta level. Like, I really had fun feeling
yep.
that horror.
Right.
But the one way that it's different is at the actual, the experience of the emotion itself while you're viewing it, you know. And so people, while they're viewing it, I don't think they would characterize it as fun.
Right.
They might reflectively characterize it as fun. So you're right. I mean, it might be all part of the same thing. I'm just hedging because I really need to.
And it's really a first study in some senses anyway.
Yeah,
right.
right.
Yeah,
so further research. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I think the ambiguity aspect does make it difficult to say if it's positive or negative, because anticipation of your hero, you know, winning or the opposite is losing is much more frightful than to have a villain, let's say, you know, winning or getting to the end and succeeding and getting away with what he or she did. So I think that fear could be positive or negative depending on the anticipated outcome
yeah.
from the viewer's standpoint of whether they like or dislike the character.
Well,
so that if it was predictable, I think that fun or that thrill would be exciting and positive, right? But then the other way around could in some ways that fear response could actually bring about a negative emotion.
Well, that actually, your comments make me think, you know, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, maybe that particular response is more physiological than the others. In other words, if it's a really scary movie, I mean, I always think of The Shining as just a really scary movie. And the first time I saw it, you know, if I had been hooked up to the various, you know, monitors, all the dials would be off the chart, right?
Yeah.
Blood pressure, everything, heart attack time. And then at the end, there's a release. Could it be that this sort of, you know, is more dominated by a physiological response than either enjoyment or appreciation, especially appreciation, which it seems to me is much more in the cognitive realm, and even beyond that, perhaps the spiritual realm, if that's what we're heading towards. Would that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's, well, certainly, I mean, we ask people just self-reported how aroused they felt.
Yeah.
That was definitely...
For thrill.
For thrill, yeah. You know. And so that made us
so
comfortable.
Just generalized arousal.
Yeah. But it was negatively associated with feeling happy.
Right. Yeah, no, and I mean, I don't think we necessarily feel happy because we saw, which I haven't seen, but... I've seen the trailers. That was enough.
It's a good movie. It is suspenseful.
Oh yeah, no, I'm sure. Well, I'm just dating myself with The Shining, you know. But Nina, I don't know if you have any other questions. I have one last question. Somewhere in there, you mentioned the finding that we're happier when the good guy wins and the you know, when justice is done, essentially, in entertainment. And that seems like a pretty standard idea. But I've discussed this with others, and there have been recent movies in particular where the good guy didn't win. You know, Leo DiCaprio gets shot in The Departed. I remember my family going, oh, no, how could
you... Just ruined it for our listeners.
Well, it's been out for a while. Spoiler alert. But, you know, and saying things like, they can't do that. You know, like, that's against the rules. Same thing in No Country for Old Men, although I guess I won't give away the ending. You know, but also the notion of anti-heroes, too.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think these are just exceptions that prove the rule, or is there... and this may be an unfair question, because I know your study wasn't about this, per se, but what do you think about that kind of issue?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the very thing that caused many people to say, hey, wait a minute. Our existing theories just don't capture the landscape of media entertainment. It's not just, you know, these notable examples here, but, you know, Romeo and Juliet, and let's just go back,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
And so I think that the examples are not only so notable, but typically they're the most praised forms of entertainment that we have.
We need Academy Awards and
exactly.
So forth.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so... That tells me not only are they worthy of our study, but we find them infinitely valuable.
Right.
And for that reason alone, I think they're really worth our attention.
Because they don't fit the standard formula of the good guy always wins, and we go out feeling happy and he gets the girl and so forth.
Yeah.
Mina, you have any final questions?
Well, one thing is, you know, the concept morally ambiguous characters that is now kind of coming into play, and some of the literature now is touching up on that these characters are morally ambiguous, and sometimes they do good, but sometimes they do bad. And, you know...
Dexter.
Yes, they're Antoni from The
House,
Sopranos.
Right?
And
Tony,
so...
Yeah.
Yeah, so some of these roles change, and I think it actually is very insightful to look at, right? Do these actually put us in these serious, pensive states or these experiences in which we are much more likely to think, wow, you know, these don't follow a formula, and maybe this novelty factor of these characters that don't fit those particular moral standards do actually put us in a position in which we're more likely to actually contemplate on these life issues and these moral beauty, you know, terms that we have talked about so far this conversation.
Yeah. Well, Mary Beth, there would be 100 more questions I'd love to ask you about based on other research you've done. We really don't have time for that, though. So I'd like to thank you for coming by.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure. Mina, thank you for sitting in as well. I just would like to remind our listeners that this is the Communication Research Podcast. For more information on the podcast and also activities of the Communication Research Center, including upcoming colloquia, you can go to www.bu.edu/com/crc. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.